how they get you. They're under the goddamn ground.
What the hell are they?
Sons of bitches.
This is the Hollywood Outsider. This is a special episode of our show. This is going to be the one that finally settles the Tremors debate. Well, if you never listened, you wouldn't know, but if you've ever listened, you know that there's a debate. We finally have it settled. We have screenwriter and author S.S. Wilson on our show today, and joining me is Justin McCumber.
What is up?
We have actually already recorded it. I thought it was it's a fantastic interview. I thought he's a great guy.
He is so entertaining. He tells amazing stories, and he's got a voice that's actually kind of perfect for podcasting and radio. Really, really a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a very, very good, time. Before we get to that real quick, remember you can always subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or through the RSS feed at our website, thehollywoodoutsider.com. He also is the writer of Short Circuit. He was one of the writers on Wild Wild West, Batteries Not Included, Tremors 1, 2, 3, 4, and the series. He was involved in all of that. What the debate has stemmed from, Justin, do you want to say what the debate is in case somebody has never heard of it?
Sure. I forget what episode number it was, but Aaron mentioned that he felt like Tremors was a science fiction movie, and I immediately had to hit the brakes and properly correct Aaron that no, indeed, Tremors is not science fiction. And from that sprang an argument that has lasted for well over a year. And today, S.S. Wilson gets to come on, the writer and creator of Tremors, to give us his definitive opinion on whether or not Tremors is or is not science fiction.
And he does. He does just that. He also gives you some insight into the process behind screenwriting, writing novels, the Hollywood industry as a whole. He's got a lot of very, like Justin said, very cool stories. And he also has a little factoid on Kevin Bacon, which I find very interesting, but I'm not going to talk about it. I want you to hear it, and so you know to listen for it.
Yes, don't spoil that piece of goodness.
Oh, that's some goodness right there. Let's stop yammering. Let's just let him talk. So here's our interview with S.S. Wilson. How come you're not based in California? Is it easier to do what you do there? Or
we came to Prescott and looked all over and found my dream house, not so much her dream house.
You got lucky there. Usually it's the other way around.
I did. So I'm on a mountaintop in Arizona. And you know, with the internet, of course, my partner and I were way ahead of the curve. Way back in the day, we used to modem scripts to each other. Think about this. It used to take 3 hours to send a 120-page script over the phone.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think
and
of that.
And if either of your phones rang during that time, you were knocked offline and you had to start all over.
We did it
before anybody else, and so but with Skype and everything else, my partner's still in Santa Monica, and so we work that way. We just get on Skype, and it's like being next door now.
Is it really still just a problem?
Yeah. Okay, it can be a hassle. We don't pitch that much anymore. We don't really make the rounds trying to sell stuff because we got very frustrated with that process. So it was easier for me to leave for that reason as well. We weren't selling. You can't sell a new idea to mainstream Hollywood. So we are, we couldn't sell Tremors, I don't think, in Hollywood today. It was hard enough back in the day. And we don't, we're not part of the club that does, comic book movies and Transformers and stuff like that. We were never kind of in that group. You know, Hollywood is very, very much being put in niches, and we're sort of considered the quirky guys, and nobody's out there looking for the quirky guys.
Which is really too bad. Because
it is. I mean, it's frustrating for us. I mean, my God, because we were kind of go-to guys for a number of years. And then now we find ourselves sort of, out in the out in the hinterlands. But our latest gig, though, is we're gonna try to set up a TV series, because we did one with Tremors, and so we're hoping to restructure ourselves, because that's where all the creativity is going on. That's where Breaking Bad and House of Cards and The Walking Dead and all of this cool stuff is being done on TV. So,
well, yeah, and we're gonna ask you more about that too as we go. We'll go back and forth, Justin and I, and we'll just have a fun conversation if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Justin, you go first.
I don't know. Maybe before we get started, I know you've communicated with Aaron. We haven't had a chance to talk yet. But some of my questions that I came up with centered more on the writing aspect of what you do. Mm-hmm. And so the first question I've got for you is, and this is one that I often ask writers when I get a hold of them, no matter what medium they're writing in, is, when did you get that bug to write?
In my case, I sort of fell into it. I had thought about it, and my dad actually had encouraged me. And I got encouragement in high school. I had a couple of fortunate situations where teachers were supportive, and there were weird federal programs came along for creative writing and stuff. So I did a little bit of that kind of stuff, and I got encouraged by people. But I was always interested in stop motion animation. That was my first love. I was one of the Ray Harryhausen converts, and I pursued that for a long time. I even did it in the Army. And
the Army?
Yeah. I got stationed at West Point as part of the division that makes educational films and videos and records things for the cadets.
Oh, wow.
And when they found out I could do stop motion, I would do these weird comedy things. They just thought it was great to get the cadets laughing before they dumped some horrible project on them. So I would do these wacky little cartoons. I still have some of them. They let me take, they gave me the, they were really great, I have to say. I mean, I was extremely lucky because the Vietnam War was still going on when this happened. And so I was very happy to get stationed at West Point and not somewhere horrible.
Oh, yeah.
And end up doing animation to boot, which was really funny. Part of the animation helped me get into USC. Anyway, so that's what I was pursuing. And I will answer your question. So I was pursuing stop motion. I went to USC. I continued to pursue stop motion. And there I did a graduate film project called Recorded Live, which is still out there in the ether somewhere, about a big reel of videotape chasing people around a TV station. And from there, I met Ron Underwood, who was doing educational films. Now, this is way back in the day when they used to roll a 16-millimeter projector out into the classroom and screen movies for kids. And there were a number of companies in Los Angeles who did these films, and you could make a decent living. And I did. Me and Ron Underwood and Brent Maddock worked on these films. They were 15, 20 minutes long, done for $50,000, $60,000. And in some cases, we produced them, or rather Ron produced them. And in some cases, we just worked for hire. But I got known as the guy who did stop motion and could do kind of effects on a budget in a market that had not seen this kind of thing. So we were pretty successful. And we did the Talking Dictionary, and we did a number of other things. And because the writers writing in that field didn't know how to write stuff that I could do on my budgets, I started writing the animation sequences, and from there it was an easy step to, we're doing how to look up a word in the dictionary or how to use the reference section. Why don't you just write the script, Steve, since you're going to be doing the animation? And I fell into it that way. So I wrote three of these movies. Brent wrote a couple of them. Ron directed them. And from there, sort of around the same time then, Brent and I, who had roomed together at USC, started doing spec scripts as well, because everybody was doing spec scripts. And we did separately and together, I think, 7 of them. And I was ready to give up. I mean, I was very depressed at this point because we couldn't get an agent to read them. We couldn't get any traction with these things. But we did a short film that had a stop motion robot in it. It was called Library Report, and it was very successful. It was wildly successful in the educational market, which is if you sell to every school and library, you're doing good.
Yeah.
And we said, gee, well, robots are cool. Well, let's write a low budget robot feature. Ron will direct it, and I'll do the robot, and we'll do a low-budget movie. And, of course, Brent and I don't really know how to write a low-budget movie, so we wrote Short Circuit, and and Ron immediately knew that we weren't going to be able to do it. And simultaneously, Brent was in a workshop, a screenwriting workshop, and it was classic. From there, it's classic Hollywood. A guy in the workshop liked the script, knew the son of David Foster, knew that David Foster was looking for any script with a robot in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the friend gave it to the son gave it to the father, and suddenly we were in his office at MGM. I mean, literally, like a week later, we were in his office at MGM, wishing we had an agent, which we had never been able to get before.
Wow.
So that's so we got catapulted from one end of the spectrum to the other. And then the movie, you know, but John Badham came on, he liked it, and thing was in production in an extraordinarily short time. So suddenly we were the screenwriter guys. So my stop motion career ended overnight.
Just like that, huh?
Yeah. And you know, and so then we were happily writing. You know, we went immediately thereafter to work at Amblin. We spent almost a year at Amblin writing for Steven Spielberg on various projects, some of them credited, some of them not. And that was an incredibly exciting period because at that time, this was before DreamWorks, you know, mm-hmm. Spielberg ran everything. It was like, in my mind, it was like working for Walt Disney.
Absolutely. I remember those days, yeah.
Because he made every decision, and it was just hysterical. He was in every meeting, and he knew your script better than you did. He would run from room to room to room, and he would come in, okay, guys, on batteries not included, page 65. You got to do this, this, and this, and then run out of the room again. We'd be like, oh, my God. So, and we worked, we kibitzed on Amazing Stories. And anyway, so we were.
Oh, you worked on Amazing Stories, too?
Oh, no, we didn't. No,
I think so.
I say we kibitzed on them. We
gotcha.
It was a busy, busy shop. All this stuff was going on in a little cluster of offices in this little Adobe building on the Universal lot. It was something like Chuck Jones describes the Warner Brothers cartoon studio. You know, everybody was running from office to office throwing ideas around. It was just delightful. And we worked, you know, Stephen asked us to talk to the director of Harry and the Hendersons. He was disagreeing with him. He said, I can't get him to do anything. You guys should talk to him. He didn't agree with us either, but it was. So, you know, we read it and gave him notes and sat down with him and talked about that. But we didn't do anything on Harry and the Hendersons. We were just part of the mix of people throwing ideas around. Anyway, so yeah, that's what happened. I fell into it from stop motion, writing short films, and then wrote a spec script, and then got pegged as a writer. And it's funny, I was perfectly happy as a writer, just as happy as I was an animator. They're both solitary things you do at, you know, 1 a.m. in the morning. So I'm a late night guy. I work, you know, sort of 8 to 1. This is my thing.
I think Justin's kind of the same way.
Long, rambling answer to your question.
No, but that is a very entertaining answer. Who or what are you inspired by? When you do write, what gets you motivated?
I am a fantasy guy. I grew up, this is how Tremors came to be. I grew up watching the B movies, you know, in the great monster era of B movies. I was a young kid in the 50s, and I read all those comics from that era. My running joke is that Steven Spielberg and I read all the same comics, except he gets more money than I do. And we,
us too.
And those are my inspirations. Those and classic science fiction and fantasy. I read all that stuff at a very young age. I was reading Jules Verne and H.G. Wells and all of these things were influences on me, and fantasy science fiction is my focus. I've never been the person to say, I want to do a story about man's inhumanity to man. If there's not a fantastical element, I'm kind of not interested. And my wife just drives her crazy. I will still, if I'm channel flipping and something weird goes by, you know, it's the girl in a boat and the water's swirling, you know, I'll stop. It doesn't matter what it is, because now I want to know what's under the water.
But if you'd rather write about man's inhumanity to Martian lizard monsters?
No, absolutely. Yeah, it'll never be ordinary people for me, which I actually have never seen.
Well, maybe they'll add lizards in the remake. That'll make it
Now, you have written a couple of novels, like this new one, Frady Cats, which I actually just ordered the Kindle copy for, because the description for it just sounds funny and really, really good. But you've also written screenwriting for films and for television. Between books and screenwriting, do you have a first love, or do you have a preference for either?
Well, I would say I like each for different reasons. I fell into screenwriting and got a crash course in John Badham on Short Circus. Really gave Brent and me good notes on how to write a screenplay that works and is shootable. So we really began developing those skills, and we continue to develop them under Steven Spielberg's tutelage. I had started a novel in 1972 or 3, Tucker's Monster. That's what I started trying to do, even before I began to make a living as a stop-motion animator. And I had just sort of set it aside as a stack of typewritten pages. And everything got set aside because for 20 years in Hollywood, we were just working all the time, which was great and lucky. So I didn't turn back to even thinking about novels until we hit this slump where suddenly we would go to meetings and they're like literally saying, well, sorry, guys, you know, your idea is not based on anything. And we would say, what do you mean? Like, well, it's not based on a novel or a comic book or, you know, another, it's not a remake of another movie. So we don't have any way to sell this to marketing. I mean, we would hear this over and over in meetings, you know, and this was a point where we could still get meetings with, you know, studio heads. And they would be telling us, sorry, we have to get marketing's approval to do anything. In fact, while we were working at Disney a few years ago, a lady that we really like was head of creative, they call it. There's head of production, which is supposedly people who crunch the numbers and make sure movies come in on budget. And then there's head of creative, quote unquote, who make the creative decision. Well, she got fired while we were writing a script at Disney.
Oh, wow.
And was replaced by the head of marketing.
Oh, that sounds bad.
So this is where, we said, boy, handwriting's really on the wall here. So that's when, you know, so things were slow. I mean, really slow. So I sat down and said, well, you know what? I'm going to finish my novel that I started 30 years ago. And so I did. And my wife and I worked together on editing and all of that stuff. And we got that published effectively on our own, really, through a small company, but we really were doing it ourselves. It's almost a, what do you call it, a self-published thing, mm-hmm. Tucker's Monster. And then, it was well-reviewed and won some awards and whatnot. So we said, oh, gee, well, at least I seem to be able to do that. So to get back to your question, I had honed all these skills as a screenwriter for many, many years and feel fairly confident that I know the form. And what was really interesting about getting into novel writing after having set it aside for 30 years was I literally had to rediscover something so ridiculously basic as you have to put in all the description. My wife read the draft of the novel and she said, well, you know, I would really like to know what these people look like and what the street looks like, you know, and I'm still in the mindset of exterior Western street, you know, and a production designer will come in and do the Western street.
Right.
That's funny.
So that was an interesting, it was amusing because it was so simplistic, and yet it was interesting. And now, to really answer your question, I really like that about writing fiction, the ability to sit back and think about everything and have it be the way I want it. Because as a screenwriter, you know, you're really not even supposed to do that. There are all these departments that are going to come in and do all of this stuff. And you can say whatever you want about how the actor looks or how he or she dresses, you know, ultimately the actor is going to have input, the director is going to input, the clothing people, casting people, everybody is going to have input on all of this stuff. And at most, what they want from you is a sketch, you know, mm-hmm. a rough idea. You know, and there is completely the reverse in a novel. So I really enjoy both films. I enjoy screenwriting, especially since my partner and I are currently finishing up this pilot we hope to take out for a TV show. It's so much faster and easier to write in television and screenwriting. You know, mm-hmm. you know, an hour TV show is like, boom, it's done in a few days.
It's just 44 pages or so, right?
Something like that, yeah. And so that's appealing in a different way. You can get something done and get it out there and have it be a finished thing in a way that a novel sort of hangs over you and keeps calling to be rewritten forever. Mm-hmm. The other thing, by the way, I do really enjoy about writing novels is having completely creative control. And that's how I got backed into, I had agents on both Frady Cats and on Tucker's Monster. I had agents go out and try to sell them to mainstream publishers. And what started happening is I started getting notes back that were exactly like the notes I get from studios. And I just flipped out. Because I said, I didn't get into this. You know, I'm not making a fortune on, I'm not making any money on Tucker's Monster yet. And I'm just not going to do that. I didn't get into this to do that. So I backed away from everything that came at me. Because in the case of Frady Cats, they said, well, this is obviously a children's book. And I said, well, I didn't really intend it that way. I wrote it in a kind of a funny way. But I didn't. They said, well, that's how it reads. And I said, and because it reads that way, you must take out the following list of 35 big words. This was a note that I got.
35 big words.
There was a list of words that they said were not acceptable. You know, and I went, okay, this is insane. There's no way I'm doing this. So.
Because we would hate to teach children
words. Right.
Yeah, no, we don't want them reading.
We wouldn't want them to be, you know, to stumble over something. So, God, I was going, you guys should read some Edgar Allan Poe. When I read Edgar Allan Poe, I have to have the dictionary beside me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His use of language is insane. I know that there's actually writers of his time who did not like what he did. And there are times when I swear he still made these words up. But most of the time, they're in the dictionary. Yeah. I go, oh, my God, there it is. I never heard this word.
Short Circuit is huge with a lot of our listeners. We just had a robot episode a few weeks ago, and it came up I don't know how many times. So why do you think Johnny Five still resonates with people? I'm sure you've talked to fans. Why do you think it still hits them?
Well, my personal theory is that he is, you know, this babe in the woods with a real problem. I think he resonates in the way that a really good kid film, and I don't know that there are that many really good kid films. I don't generally like kid films. In fact, we backed away from two directors who wanted to add little kids to Short Circuit when we first were trying to sell it.
To make it cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he resonates because he's like a little kid, and he has this enormous problem, which is people are trying to kill him. and his problem is he can't convince them that he's alive. And that's my feeling, is that kids relate to Johnny Five because he's got this problem and nobody will listen to him, you know, and I think how kids feel. And of course, I mean, and it's very funny, you know, John Badham, you know, and the whole team, the puppeteers and the roboteers, you know, they brought, Johnny to life, a name, a Johnny that we didn't like. you know why he's called Johnny Five is purely a marketing thing.
What do you mean a marketing thing?
Because they got the song "Who's Johnny," which at the time
oh my God, they pulled the name from the song.
Yes, they did.
Oh my gosh,
never knew that one. Yeah, it was they got the song, which of course was a one-hit wonder, so people hear the song and what the hell is that. And all these years later. But yes, that's how About Johnny came up. Late in post-production.
What was his name in your script?
Number Five. Oh,
Number Five. Okay.
So he was Number Five. He still is. And it cracks me. It's to this day when a fan says, I love Johnny Five. I have to think to myself, oh, that's my robot. Yeah.
Well, but I think you're right. You know, he is so childlike. And when a lot of our listeners, including us, watched it, we were kids ourselves, and anytime someone like you is doing something heroic on screen, it's going to resonate and stick with you.
I agree. Yeah.
Now, do you have any screenplays that you wrote and you love, but they just never landed with anyone?
Yeah, I have a dark, dark science fiction one that I wrote separately from Brent that I'm always, that has been universally disliked.
Really? Disliked?
And I, yes. Oh, yes. Hmm. People, I mean, they actively dislike it. And I, to this day, I don't know what's wrong with it. I think I may turn it into a novel. I think it may, part of the problem is it may be, it starts very slow. It's one of these things that starts very slow. And Brent and I have always struggled with this. We strongly believe that things need to be set up. You need to understand who characters are, and you need to understand what the rules of the situation are and what the world is. You know, Tremors suffered from this. You know, they just hated the beginning of Tremors, and we ended up having to cut stuff in the beginning that we really didn't want to.
Because they just
want
to get right to the...
Oh, you got to get to the Graboids. Come on, guys. It's taking forever to get going. And we still believe that those kinds of setups pay dividends in the end. You know, when the audience understands who the people are and understands what the rules are, you can do really cool surprises and really cool character moments that resonate much better than they do if you're just racing along.
You worry more about those characters if you know them and like them.
Absolutely.
I agree. So it's an ongoing battle. Anyway, this film noir, sci-fi, dark sci-fi thing that I did, it suffers from that. In fact, I fairly recently actually hired a guy to review it for me to give me notes on it. And
really?
And he said the same thing. He said, "Oh my God, it just starts so slow, and it does, and you just don't know where it's going, and you don't know what this guy." And it, and by the way, it may be flawed. You know, a lot of Brent and I have a long, long history together, and we're yin and yang in a way. You know, I'm kind of the story guy, and he's kind of the character guy, and a lot of the character stuff that people really love in our movies come from Brent's side of the equation. So I think when I write on my own, at least in screenplay form, hopefully not in novel form, maybe that stuff gets shortchanged in a way because I've relied on Brent all these years to do it. But anyway, to answer your question, we got that one, or I've got that one, and then we have a buddy comedy that we still don't understand why people didn't like it. We thought it was really great. It all takes place in the Midwest. And it's a CIA agent. Let's see, what was the setup? They bungled. Oh, they set up a hit. In order to catch a high-end hitman, they set up a hit on a guy who's already dead, and they give him the social security number of a guy who's already dead, but they get the number wrong and send the hitman off to kill a guy in Iowa.
I like it.
So the setup seems right to me, and we were really trying to be mainstream. You know, because we were having trouble selling things. We said, well, let's just write a spec, you know, that's a buddy comedy. This is a few years ago. It's what people were looking for. They wanted buddy comedies. They always want buddy comedies. Mm-hmm. We figured, okay, any two stars can play this. But there again, you know, it kind of went out, and managers read it, and some studio people read it, and it was kind of not based on anything.
You know. You really just never know, do you?
No, you know you don't. No, you don't.
Well, maybe you can.
You get pigeonholed too. I mean, we're old guys. We're old guys, and we're kind of old news.
You need your hitman to be a part-time stripper, and then you hire Channing Tatum to be the villain. Then boom, you're practically flowing in money.
Exactly.
I want to ask you about Wild Wild West. I know you're part of that writing team, which I personally thought was a fun film. I don't really care what the critics thought. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to write a huge film like that? Because I assume it was by committee.
Well, it wasn't. And on our end, here's what happened. The two guys whose idea it was to buy the rights to the show hired us. They had already had several scripts done that they did not like. And they came to us and said, you know, you're quirky guys, and we think this needs a quirky thing. And they gave us a list of things. No atom bombs, no dirigibles. And we said, fine, no atom bombs, no dirigibles. And we loved the show. And we rewatched the show. We got in touch with the fan club that was publishing these delightful little mimeographed newsletters. and we just steeped ourselves in the show, and then wrote a script that we thought, you know, was a great update of the show. And that script first lay fallow for a while. I forget why, but the studio didn't move forward, Warner Brothers. And then suddenly, like a number of months or even a year later, suddenly they called us and said, you owe us another draft, and we're going, and Barry Sonnenfeld is doing it. And we're like, holy crap, okay. And he liked it, and then Will Smith liked it. So suddenly it went from, hey, let's do a TV show remake, to it's a giant movie. Mm-hmm. So we did owe them another draft, not technically, you know, not according to the Writers Guild, because they had never they had never told us to do it, and the time had run out, but we didn't care. So we ran back and said, sure. So yes, it was, but our part of it ends before the story you probably want. So we went back, we had meetings with Barry Sonnenfeld, John Peters got put on it suddenly, who knew nothing about it. I mean, so nothing about it. It's inconceivable. In his first meeting, he asked us why there were horses in it.
What?
Absolutely had no idea what it was. And the studio put him on because it was a big movie, and he is awesome. A big producer. I mean, this is how that side of Hollywood works. And it was one of our few experiences with this kind of giant side of the business, because a lot of our stuff has been, you know, Tremors and that kind of stuff. And so it was appalling in one way. So first you're bringing John Peters up to speed. Well, it's based on a TV show, and it's a Western. And do you remember that motor-powered big wheel cycle?
Yes.
That's in there because John Peters said, well, this is insane. We can't have a movie with just horses in it. This is insane. We got to have a car or a motorcycle or something. And so Brent, who's very fast on his feet in meetings, said, well, how about a nitroglycerin-powered bicycle? Cool, nitrocycle, do it. So that's why that's in there.
So have you ever heard the Kevin Smith story where he talks about when he was pitching an idea or something, you know, with the giant spider and all that?
For Superman, because they asked him to write a Superman treatment, and John Peters was just effing that one up as well.
And through the spider from into, well, I don't know if you'd ever heard that. I was just kind of curious if you'd heard that story.
I've heard fragments of that story, yeah. So we wrote the giant mechanical spider because we thought, what a great steampunk thing to do. Peters nixed that idea and told us we had to rewrite the script with a stealth bomber. And we said, well, surely you don't mean a stealth bomber. He said, yes, I do. And we said, well, but it's, I remember the horses in the 1880,
you know,
I don't care. So our heads were spinning at this point. And we said, well, can we make it, and we finally just sort of danced around it and said, can we make it sound a little bit like 1880s? As long as it flies and it's cool. Yes. So we wrote a whole draft with this weird flying machine that it was kind of cool, I think. It was all steampunky and kind of a giant hovercraft battleship thing. Actually, kind of like the thing in X-Men, come to think of it. A steampunk version of that. Sort of getting to the punchline here. So Barry flew us to New York because he likes to work in New York. So we set us up there to do our final draft, and we got notes. And then there was one more giant meeting at John Peters' house. Actually, this is before the New York period, in which Barry said, thank God, this is kind of the only good thing that happened to us on this movie. Mm-hmm. Barry said, you know, I really don't like the big flying machine. There's like 20 people in the room, studio, because it's a huge movie, you know, so everybody's involved. Studio executives are there, and I don't know, agents and managers, I don't know who the hell is there, in Peter's gigantic mansion. This is a quick side story. This is how big the mansion is. I was walking toward the garage, because the garage had, the garage was many, many garages with houses above them, all clustered together, and I thought it was the house. It was all living quarters for maids and butlers and things. And eventually somebody said, where are you going? And I said, well, am I going to the house? No, the house is through the giant hedge over there. So that was, I was going to the garage and I didn't know it. So anyway, Barry said, I really don't like this big flying machine at the end. I wish there was something else we could do. It's just going to, I'm going to be up in the air. I'm not going to know where I am. It's, I'm going to be looking at blue screen all the time. I think it's going to be hard to kind of, you know, get drama out of this. It's just going to be up in the air. And, you know, me and Brent are back in the back corner of the room just listening to all this stuff. And so I tentatively raised my hand and said, well, you know, there is an earlier version of the script with a giant walking war machine, a kind of a giant spider. And Sonnenfeld said, oh, I'd like to see that. That sounds interesting. And one of the studio executives, I kid you not, stood up as though he were a military guy and said, I really support that, Mr. Sonnenfeld.
Bootlicker number one stands up and says,
oh, my God. Oh, my God. Brent and I are just cringing. Well, thank God we, you know, we had all of those pages ready to go. So we gave those to Barry, and he said, great, I love Walking Machine better. And I thought the spider was like the best thing in the movie to me. I love that thing. And so then he gave us all these other notes and various things that they wanted done. And it became a done deal that Will Smith was going to become the only black security agent, Secret Service man in 1880. And which we didn't strongly disagree with that. We thought it was weird, but we thought, well, maybe.
Because
maybe.
it went against the history.
Well, yeah, it is so against the history. And, the audience, everybody, you know, black and white, understands, you know, well, that just isn't, that doesn't make any sense. But at the same time, you know, Will's a huge star, so what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And probably it is a good idea. And they've done enormous hit movies together. Well, okay, so we turn in our next draft. We've done everything that Barry asked. We've changed it back to a spider. And that is the last word we heard from anybody ever again on the movie. That's why I say the story has a disappointing ending. Many writers followed us, including in post-production when it did not test well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were surprised we ended up sharing credit with anybody. We didn't think we were going to get screen credit because, frankly, there's very little left of our script. In the version that is on the screen.
Were there some major differences in terms of the storytelling that actually happened in the movie? Where it was like, that is not the way it went down at all. We went in a completely different direction.
I have not reread my script in a long time. I believe it is floating around on the internet out there somewhere. I can't really officially hand out scripts that belong to studios.
Yeah,
but
right.
I think it is out there if you look for it. My memory is that there was a few lines of dialogue here and there left, and the spider itself, but all the references to the show and the little in jokes that we did for the fans. We had a running joke that the steam locomotive was the wrong locomotive, had the wrong number on it. We were going to freak the fans out, and then the train gets destroyed, and President Grant gives them a new train at the end, and then it has the right number on the locomotive.
Oh, I gotcha.
I mean, it was written to that kind of depth to be true to the show. And anyway, so we don't know anything about the rest of the production. The next time we heard from anybody involved with the production was when we got our tickets to the... to the premiere. And it was at least 9 writers that followed us.
Yeah, there's a lot of credits.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, for a long time, movies held a really high position over television. TV was kind of where actors either went to die or where the lesser stories seemed to be told. But over the last, I'd probably say the last at least 5-6 years, television has really upped its game to the point where it's now drawing a lot of TV stars to come to it. Halle Berry's got Extant. We've got House of Cards, which features 2 huge movie stars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do you feel like the best writing is found today? Is it now in TV, or do you think film still stands above it?
As a group, definitely TV.
Yeah, no as question. A group.
Yeah, as a mass entertainment, definitely television. There's just all the good writing is going on. Not all, except for the independents, except for Wes Anderson, Chris Nolan, people with enough power to tell the studio, I'm going to make a movie about dreams and there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
except for those powerful independents and powerful directors, you know, Martin Scorsese, Clint Eastwood, who can just say, I'm going to do this. I don't care what you say. Mm-hmm. Except for those people, everything else is driven by marketing and entirely by marketing. And you get, and at the most extreme, Battleship the movie. And you have the head of a studio, you know, making public announcements about why this is a good idea and defending the idea and saying, yes, it's going to be a good movie, when he has no idea what he's talking about. And so, yeah, television for sure. And that's why Brent and I are going to try to move that way. You know, we have a pilot that we think is really quirky. It's typical Brent and Steve stuff. And I don't want to talk about the genre only because we're not out there in the marketplace yet.
Gotcha.
And we got approached by someone who realized we weren't dead, who said, hey, you guys, you know, you Tremors guys, do you have any TV ideas? Because that's where I'm selling. He's a manager. And we said, well, I don't know. Do we have any TV ideas? We found television very difficult. We executive produced and wrote most of the TV series. No, I shouldn't say wrote most of, wrote some of, and oversaw the writing of a staff on the series, and it was very hard. we don't know that we necessarily want to plunge into that again. I'd have to leave my desert mountaintop. I'd have to go back to Hollywood.
Maybe you could shoot it right there in Arizona.
Well, maybe we'll shoot it in Prescott. There you go. Know. Hey, whoa, there's a solution right there.
Problem solved. Well,
in today's interconnected world, do you still have to be in Los Angeles to write or be involved?
It depends on what you're doing. Kind of yes is the short answer. If you're just writing the way I was, because I was gone off and on from 1990 on, I tried to be, except when I came back and got really intensive into directing, producing Tremors in sort of 2000 to 2006 or 7 or whenever that was. And if you're just writing, you know, it's pretty seamless. You know, everybody reads PDFs now. You know, there's no messengers driving scripts all over, which there were back in the day. Mm-hmm. If you're producing, selling, pitching, you kind of got to be in L.A., really, because you got to be ready to drop everything and run to a meeting kind of thing. It's all less true than it was, partly because, of course, production takes place all over the world now. I mean, you know, Hollywood is no longer the seat of production by any means.
It's too expensive.
The right-to-work states are in Canada have been taking the work away for decades now. And, and entities and companies are set up in the Pacific Northwest and in the Southeast, you know, and working happily there, doing weird low-budget stuff and other kinds of things. So it is less true than it was, but for mainstream studio Hollywood, the business still takes place in L.A.
I got a personal question for you.
Sure.
I have to mention Heart and Souls because I was actually a big fan of that movie.
Thank you. You must be the fifth or sixth one now.
Well, I thought Robert Downey Jr. and Charles Grodin were great.
They were.
What was the inspiration for that? And I'm really sorry. More people need to go see that movie. It's out there. Go find it.
I know.
What's that?
It's astonishing. It's that movie baffled everyone. The studio was really behind it, and we were so lucky to get Robert off of, I think he had just gotten his Academy Award. And Robert was in the best of shape at that time. He had another bad period after that, but he was mm-hmm. absolutely wonderful to work with for us. And I'm sorry, what was the question, though?
What was the inspiration for it?
It was a movie that the two guys that share screenplay credit did. It was a short film and a very moving but very dark short film called Seven Souls. Mm-hmm. And it was that idea. I mean, the whole basic idea is these two guys. And I'm sorry, their name escapes me at the moment. And we worked with them on the screenplay. And the film just got a lot of notice. It was very moving. It was very dark. Mm-hmm. Very negative. But it was this little kid who lived with these seven ghosts. and we reduced it to 4 because it was an overwhelming number to try to deal with in a feature.
Right.
It's the same problem you have with the X-Men. You know, well, you know, the Wolf guy gets 3 pages, and then Halle Berry has to get a page, and oh my God. Mm-hmm. So they were not happy about that. They were very dedicated to the idea that it was 7 souls, and all each of those 7 souls were very real to them. They're very real characters, you know. So even that was a small battle to be hashed over. But that was the inspiration, and Brent and I expanded the short film idea into a feature length idea, giving it, you know, a more conventional 3-act structure. And then the other big change that we brought to it was to make it more upbeat.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in the short film, and I've not seen it in 25 years, I believe in the short film they just leave the guy at the end, and he's just devastated, and I think is what happens. I may be wrong about that. And you can probably find that online now, too. I just realized. Of course you can.
That sounds awfully dark. I'd rather watch this one.
Well, it was. And they understood that the studio didn't want to make a 90-minute movie that ends that way. But as a kind of a Twilight Zone, which is what, you know, sort of what it was, it worked quite well. And, mm-hmm. and it was just like, oh, my God, you're sort of sitting there with your mouth open. Wow, this is so weird. But it was sort of the germ of the idea appealed to people. And then the comedy, the potential for comedy, attracted Ron, and so we all pitched together on it and turned it into this more lighthearted thing, you know. And I joke about people not seeing it. In fact, anybody who ever mentions it to me loves it.
I loved it. Yeah, I saw it when it came out.
I have had many people tell me that one of the things they do with it, and this is kind of touching, is they send it, or back in the VHS days at least, they would buy a copy and send it to friends who had lost someone. Anyway, I found that very touching.
That is very sweet.
That is really touching.
It was a complete mystery how it just missed completely. You know, why wasn't it, you know, The Ghost of Mrs. Muir or what's the movie with Jimmy Stewart and the big rabbit character, Harvey?
Oh, Harvey.
You know. We don't know why it didn't hit that chord, or maybe it was the wrong time. You never know. You never know. But boy, it tanked.
It did. I remember when it came out, and it was gone in, you know, a couple weeks or something. And I always felt bad because you could always tell Robert Downey Jr. was that guy that just could never connect. I mean, he just had a hard time with hits. He was always a quality actor, but he really didn't bring, like, his movies just didn't perform well financially, I guess.
I guess so.
And yeah. Which is really too bad, because that one was a really sweet, fun movie. I really like it.
Well, he needs to start talking about this movie because now his name is golden.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
Now, I'd be remiss if I know a lot of our listeners are interested in film, many of them interested in getting into film. If, you know, if someone is a novelist or a screenwriter, how would you advise them about getting their work to Hollywood these days?
Well, it is. It's always hard. It's always been hard. And it's, you can do the exact opposite of everything I did and succeed. And I was not very aggressive. I put myself, I did do this. I continued writing. And if you're writing novels, keep writing novels and keep putting them out there, because one of them will make click. And that will do it. If you're the big upside to writing novels is that if one of them clicks, gets any notice at all, marketing will notice, because that's who's paying attention and that's who you're selling to, is marketing. Forget studio executives, directors, cast.
Mm-hmm.
So any way that you can get any notoriety to yourself, from YouTube or from reviews or from sales, of any form, will help you, because marketing is in mainstream Hollywood, that's the only people making decisions, and they are making those decisions based on, is this name known in the marketplace? Does anybody know this name in the marketplace? And if the answer is yes, then we are interested and we will come and steal it from you and give you nothing for it. So if I may be cynical for a moment.
Absolutely.
Not steal it from you. I mean, pay you a pittance and buy all of your rights forever. That's a different conversation.
Yeah,
how to avoid losing all of your rights forever. Because when you sell a screenplay, of course, it's part of the system that you sell it outright always, and that's an ongoing discussion I have with fans all the time. Why don't you guys make Tremors 5? Well, because I don't own Tremors 5. I do not make that decision. I have nothing to say about Tremors 5. I wrote a script for Tremors 5 10 years ago, but the studio does not want to make it and may never make it. Although, actually, that's not true. Actually, come to think of it, speaking of things to talk about, the studio has announced that they are not announced. They whispered to us that they are thinking about making Tremors 5 after all these years.
I'm making a Tremors 5 or remaking? I always figured they would just remake it at some point.
I've been utterly baffled as to why the studio doesn't remake it. Tremors did okay in the theaters. It wasn't a runaway hit, but it did okay. And made its money back, you know. And it wasn't the hit that, you know, Kevin Bacon wanted it to be. Well, would like it to have been. He does not like the movie, unfortunately. But
oh, really?
Oh, it's so sad. It's so sad.
I did not know that. That's honestly a little tidbit. I didn't know. He doesn't like it. Why?
He considers it the bottom of his career, the low point of his career.
What?
I don't understand it.
I got 15 other movies I could point him to that he was in.
I should be really clear. He has never said this to us. He has said this in interviews. Mm-hmm. He could not have been more professional. We never had a clue on the movie that he was remotely unhappy. He killed himself. He worked really hard. He was brilliant to work with. I think it's one of his best performances of his career.
I agree.
And it's very different from a lot of the other stuff he's done. It really shows his range.
I mean, I never heard anybody shout, fuck you, better than he did.
Better than he did. Oh, man, it was amazing. And I forget how I got off on that. I didn't mean to get off on that.
No, that's okay.
That's the first thing. Anything you can do to make noise in any other market will help you. Beyond that, it's the same old, same old. It's contact anybody you know that is in any way connected to Hollywood. By the way, I did not do a lot of this stuff. I did my animation. I worked for Ron in the short film business. Brent was the one who went to coffee shops and occasionally met people and got into that writing workshop. That's another reason, by the way, to be in L.A. is to do things like that. Go to Writers Guild meetings, go to workshops, you know, where you're hanging out with people who are working. That's probably the biggest reason, maybe, to be in L.A. is you're constantly bumping into people, hopefully, who are working.
Mm-hmm.
I was never good at that. And then at the opposite end of the spectrum, Brent and I were not particularly good at hanging out with studio executives. You know, we weren't golf players, and we didn't go to basketball games and do the other things that they wanted to do. And we don't understand business at all. We're terrible businessmen, both of us. And so when you're dealing with a studio executive who just came, you know, as the head of marketing at Coca-Cola, and now he's running a studio, you find that you have very little to talk about unless you understand business. I mean, I joke about it, but it's really true. We did not know how to talk to these guys because you couldn't talk story to them. You couldn't talk character.
Mm-hmm.
Hanging out. So one reason to be in LA is to do that kind of thing. If you're that kind of person, if you are comfortable networking or can force yourself to network, it is a good thing to do. Because putting yourself in the path of the chance encounters that lead to doors opening, because that's always what it is. It's always chance encounters leading to doors opening.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to put yourself in the path of those chance encounters. And part of the way you do that is by being there. Part of the way you do that is by contacting anybody you can who's open to hearing you, reading. Go ahead and get the Writers Guild list of open agents. They're still out there. It almost never works, but it can hurt to try it, especially now. It's not so expensive. You don't have to, you know, make 50 Kinko's copies and mail them.
Pay for all that stamps.
Yeah, really. And you will get ignored just the way we did when we were mailing these things off. But that's the only thing to do is to keep trying ways to get it out there. And it doesn't hurt, by the way, you know, if you're a younger person, it doesn't hurt to go to film school. Film schools are very different from when we went to USC. We were all cool hippies and anti-Hollywood at USC. It's like, oh, we could care less about Hollywood, you know, and Hollywood had the same view of film school, you know, even David Foster, you know, who produced Short Circuit. He's a very old world classic, you know, producer, and he always called us the USC Mafia. He was very suspicious of me and Ron and Brent. He felt like we had some kind of secret network that we were operating, because that's the way he operated. I mean, David is a classic producer. I mean, he knows everybody, calls everybody, goes to lunch all the time with everybody. He's a networker extraordinaire. And I've been in the office with him. He's called everybody. He'd get a weird question. So I should call Martin about that. And he will.
That's great.
Martin will pick up the phone, you know, so, cause David has a long, long track record and that's how he operates. So anyway, but the reverse is true. Now, film schools are very aggressive about getting their students in front of Hollywood, and Hollywood is always looking for the next new thing. The one place where they're interested in creativity is, in the YouTube world and in the at the end of the semester screenings of film schools, the big film schools, NYU, USC, the agents, well, at least a few years ago, and I haven't checked into this maybe in even 10 years, but long after I left USC, it had completely switched to five students watching your student film to a big screening at a big auditorium built by George Lucas where the agents showed up and they watched the films. And if your film clicked, you might get a call from an agent.
Wow.
So it is a reason to go to film school, as expensive as it is. Ron and Brent and I, that what we should have done is met just off campus and we would have saved thousands of dollars. were the only ones who helped each other. But that's the other reason, by the way. The other reason to go to film school, if that's an option in your life, is you meet like-minded people and they're all going to be of different talents. And Hollywood, God knows, is a collaborative medium that requires a lot of different talents to get any movie off the ground. And you will be in... Everybody's in the same boat. Everybody wants the same thing. They want to work in the film business, you know, and my classmates went out from USA and did all kinds of stuff, you know, the location managers and camera assistants and, you know, Ron directing and Brent and me writing. And one of my classmates is a producer on Walking Dead.
Oh, really? So,
yeah, Skip Skulnick.
Nice.
And, hadn't seen or heard of Skip in years, and I'm watching The Walking Dead and go, holy shit, there's Skip. So...
Let me call him up.
Yeah, really. Yeah, can I write an episode? Which I should do, by the way, but I won't.
You should. Just do it.
I know. I should. But I don't. I've never done that. I've never done, and you are supposed to do that. And I will tell you, you're supposed to do that, even though I didn't do that. I had a very hard time making those kinds of calls, and I usually didn't. And drive my wife crazy that work would come to me anyway. You know, I would do my weird little animations. Well, even Ron. Ron hired me originally because... This is a running joke. He hired me originally because I showed all my animations. Everybody who had a film when we started at USC showed their films in a big, you know, meeting. And so get to know each other meeting. And like years later, whenever we left and Ron hired me to do the first educational film, he said, you know, I always wanted to use your films and your animation in something from that first day at SC. That's why we always said, well, gee, we shouldn't have gone to SC. You know,
saved a fortune.
My step in Hollywood was taken that day. I didn't realize it.
Well, I don't want to take up your whole day, and I appreciate you telling us, indulging our curiosity about all this stuff.
It's fine. I do enjoy it. We haven't gotten to the question that started this all.
Oh, we're ready. You ready? I've got a couple Tremors questions now.
Okay, go ahead.
We're ready to get there. First up, this franchise has been really quite the machine for you over the years. Did you ever think you would spawn several sequels and a TV series?
Oh, absolutely not. It was a great coming together of technologies. Tremors was a classic, okay movie. The studio was surprised it wasn't a big hit. They took the blame entirely on themselves. They said they felt that they marketed it really wrong. And the marketing department was really just baffled how to sell Tremors because it was funny and it was scary and they just didn't know what to do. And they said, well, we'll sell it as a horror film. And it'll cross over. And that was their decision. And we didn't know. That's fine by us, you know, other than the poster that we hated. And
With the graboid.
The Jaws graboid?
Yeah,
the Jaws graboid. It was awful. And the crew hated it. Everybody hated it. We could not. That was the one battle we lost because we had a lot of creative control in Tremors and a lot of support from Tom Pollock, from Jim Jacks, you know, our direct executive, and Tom Pollock, head of the studio, called us personally after it came out and said, you know, this picture should have done better and we screwed this up somehow and I don't know how and I really apologize. And so, but Hollywood is Hollywood. It's over. So move on. So sometime later, and you guys would have to look it up. I don't know when it is. We get this call from this new division at Universal, the video division. And they give us this backhanded compliment. We have to have Tremors 2. You go, really? No, we absolutely have to have it. We could sell an empty box with Tremors 2 on it.
And then you're like, well, why don't you do that?
I go, well, I'm not sure that's a compliment, but let's... So, you know, so I sat down with our then partner, our agent, now partner, Nancy Roberts and Brent Maddock. And we said, well, gee, do we have an idea for Tremors 2? I don't know. And I had always wanted to do Little Monsters again, because I come out of, you know, the Million B movies and I've seen all that stuff. And I knew that the fans were waiting for the Queen Graboid. I said, okay, there's no way we're doing the Queen Graboid. But what do we do if you don't do the Queen Graboid? What do you do? How do you top yourself? And I thought, well, could we get away with this? Could we get away with baby monsters? And we even sat down with Tom and Alec, you know, the creature guys at Amalgamated Dynamics, and they were cautious about it too. They said, well, you know, babies are inherently cute. Baby snakes are even cute. I don't know.
Oh boy.
And I said, okay, well, can you make something that's ugly cute? And so anyway, we came up with Shriekers. So now, Crossroads. The studio says, so the video division kicked this off. VHS had just become a thing. People mm-hmm. were renting VHS videotapes back in the day, right? Mm-hmm. And suddenly this is a market that never existed. And here's this division discovering that if they put the name Tremors on a box, it will sell. So as long as it's made for a budget. So they said, the video division desperately wants Tremors 2. So first the feature division has to sign off on this idea. So this is, this is how we got caught in this is how we discovered what Kevin Bacon really thought. They said, well, if Kevin and Fred will come back, it'll be a feature and then it'll go to video. Oh, okay. So we fly to New York because Kevin lives up in upstate New York mm-hmm. and we get a hotel room and we bring Kevin down and have this long meeting with him and we beg him to be in Tremors 2. And we say, you know, you're the greatest thing in that movie and da, da, da. And again, please understand, Kevin has said in a couple of interviews, he has made disparaging remarks about mm-hmm. Tremors and about being so depressed that he was out in the desert with plastic worms and how did my career come to this? He never said that to us, and he did not say that on this day. He mm-hmm. said, I really appreciate what you're saying. I appreciate that you want me to come back. I'm really at a crossroads in my career. And this was true, by the way. Air Up There had flopped, and you know, his big, big hit of Footloose was really his biggest thing, and he was really struggling with, as an actor, it's really, really hard to have been a leading man and go, God, am I not a leading man? What the hell is going on? All I can get is worms. And he said, well, here's what people say to me about that movie. They never come up and say, God, you were great in that movie. They always come up and go, God, those worms are so cool.
Oh, I gotcha.
And so it's death for an actor. You've been upstaged by plastic worms. And what's so sad about that to me is it's because Kevin is so good that people think the worms are cool. If Kevin had been terrible, the worms would not be nearly as cool.
The movie would just be
laughable. Mm-hmm. It is Kevin's commitment to those worms that make them work. But there you go. So he said no. So then the feature division said, okay, not a feature. Video can have it. So that means your budget is not $12 million. Your budget is $5 million. So good luck.
Hmm.
But we were happy. We were, God, Tremors too. Why not? And I got to direct. This is what brought me back to Hollywood. I was living in Arizona, and I thought I had left Hollywood. and because I was only writing, so again, we already had the internet and all this stuff, so I was sending my scripts to, I could do.
You're like the Godfather. You keep leaving and they keep pulling you back in.
Yeah, and so I got to direct, and so I came back and reestablished myself in Hollywood and got a house, and we did Tremors 2, and it did really well. It was huge in the direct-to-video market, you know, mainstream Hollywood. Now this was like worse than working in television in those days. You were really a hack now, and so we had our fans and we had our success, and we were being paid minimum to do these things, but we had total creative control because Patty Jackson, one of the executives at Universal Home Video, who was still there, was a very, very good executive, very smart, very good with creative decisions as well as production decisions, a very unusual executive. And absolutely, you know, because they only wanted a box of Tremors 2 on it, they kind of didn't care what we did also.
Yeah, just the box.
It did not matter to them in a very dark way. And so Tremors 2 was a hit, and Tremors 3 followed fairly quickly. And then my partner Brent directed that one. So we both got to direct something we had never dreamed of doing, really. And only because I had directed second unit on Tremors did I even consider it. I never saw my, you know, I'm a solitary guy. I write and I animate. And I thought, oh, I can't handle a crew. But then I got the bug and said, I'll do it. So Tremors 3 followed, and Tremors 3 did well, even though they advertised it even less. Tremors 2, there was actually a press junket. They treated VHS movies in the early days as mini movies.
I remember that. Yeah, the
marketing machine went to work, and they sent me and Michael Gross all over the country on a junket, and we hyped the movie to rooms full of in one place. In the Midwest, we were in a warehouse stacked miles high, like the warehouse in Raiders of the Lost Ark with VHS tapes, pitching to three guys who sell videotapes in the Midwest.
No, really?
We have Tremors 2. You should put it in your giant stack here.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
It was great. It was just great. You know, but then Tremors 3, they did next to nothing. Tremors 4, they did absolutely nothing. They literally didn't so much as put out a press release that it was coming out, and hardcore fans didn't know that Tremors 4 had come out.
Really? Wow. And then you ended up doing the series as well.
Yeah, we did series back to back with Tremors 4. We did series first and then Tremors 4. In fact, I left the series to direct Tremors 4. The last two episodes were still being shot, so I left Brent executive producing the series and ran to the location for Tremors 4, and Michael Gross, we had to pull out, we had to write around his schedule in the series to get him into Tremors 4. It was so funny. They get so weird at studios. They would not wait 3 weeks to start Tremors 4.
You're kidding me.
You're just scratching your head. Going, really? I mean, it's you, you're the guys making the money. Both of these things will be better if Michael Gross is in both of them. What is wrong with waiting 3 weeks? You know, I don't know.
What is it that you remember, you know, most fondly about that very first film? Because Kevin Bacon's opinion aside, and I really think all he needs to do is go to Comic-Con, get up on stage and say, how is that Tremors? And he would see just how beloved that movie is. And not just because of Rap Boys.
Yeah, I keep hoping that will happen, because I'm sort of baffled by it. I know that he came in to do work at ADI for Hollow Man, and Tom and Alec told me, because Tom and Alec's studio is full of Graboids, you know, and all the other monsters they've made, and he glanced at the Shriekers and made a wry comment. He said, you know, my kids love that movie, Tremors 2. Mm-hmm. And I thought at the time, oh, well, maybe he's made his peace with it. But then later, well, even now, there's a fellow doing a, oh, this is something I want to promote, by the way. I forgot.
Go ahead.
Jonathan Melville in Scotland is writing the book that Tremors fans have been waiting for. He has spoken to just about everyone alive who has worked on everything from the first movie to the last TV show. He has 60, 100, I don't know how many interviews. And his book on Tremors is going to be, I predict, you know, the thing that it should be, and everything you wanted to know, more than you ever wanted to know about all of Tremors.
Wow.
And the only person that will not speak to him is Kevin Bacon.
Get out of here.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'm losing respect for Kevin. We gotta
I don't know
go.
What it is. I don't know why it's so deep-seated.
But what do you remember most fondly about that first film?
It was, for me and Brent, it was the return to creative control, which we did not have. As much fun as we were having writing all these wacky movies that we wrote, Heart and Souls and Batteries Not Included, and even Land Before Time we worked on, and Short Circuit 2, we were coming out of the educational film market where we did everything. I mean, mm-hmm. literally everything. We moved lights and we took turns editing and we cut the sound and we mixed. We were astonished at how writers were ignored once the movie got rolling and had no input, you know, at all. And we would complain to our agent about this. And she said, well, you guys, you know, writers don't have any power. You really need to produce. And if you want to produce, you're going to have to write something that you control. You can't just continue rewriting remakes and or taking other people's assignments. So that's how Tremors came to be. And it was an effort on the part of me and Brent to get back to having more say over the whole production. And from that, we backed into, well, hey, let's have our friend Ron direct it, because he was still doing short films at the time. They were still being done. Mm-hmm. And so we made ourselves a package, and we took the package around town. And with Nancy's help, we could not have done this without Nancy orchestrating all of this and handpicking the people to whom we spoke. And finally landing us with Jim Jacks, who just passed away last year, and who was a classic studio executive. He was completely the reverse of the system now. But anyway, rather than go off on that tangent, let me answer your question. What was utterly delightful for us was being on the set every day, helping decisions, bugging Ron, telling him he's doing everything wrong, and to the point where Michael Gross came over to us one day and said, guys, you know, if you're going to talk to Ron every time he gives me a direction, can we all just talk at the same time? That we realized we were probably being a little too overt and had to back off.
Did he have the elephant gun in his hand when he said that?
As a matter of fact, it was that scene.
Oh, really?
You aren't joking, but it was that scene. Great. We were in the basement, and he was doing the line, broke into the wrong goddamn rec room. And everybody knew that that was an important line, and we were all nervous about it. And, you know, Michael was nervous, Ron was nervous, we were nervous, we knew it needed to work, and we didn't know exactly when it was perfect, we weren't sure. And so he would do the line and drop the gun. We broke that poor old shotgun, and which was the only antique we had on the set. It was actually a special antique gun. We broke the stock. And he would do the line, and then we'd run over and confer with Ron, and then Ron would go talk to Michael. So finally Michael came over and said, can we have this discussion together? And we were like, okay, we'll shut up now. But it was just so exciting. It was scary because, you know, we were responsible for everything, and the studio was looking over our shoulder, and, you know, but it couldn't have been better, though. Everybody was great. Gail Ann Hurd had come in. Nancy, again, had orchestrated all of this. She had literally just, I don't know how to describe it, how she strung the right people together. She knew that Ron would be a hard sell coming out of the short film market. She got Gail to look at his films, because even then, studio guys are not filmmakers. They don't really know how to look at a film and know whether it's good or bad. They can tell you whether they like it or not. They don't know whether it's good or bad. And Gail is a filmmaker, and she got Gail to come on executive producer pretty much to give Ron the stamp of approval, which she did. And then Gail was very involved early on until she saw that we knew what we were doing. She's a low budget, you know, hard scrabble filmmaker. And mm-hmm. she said, okay, I get it. She came to the set and said, yep, it's a movie.
That's
and
great.
Then she came back a couple more times, and she came in post-production, and she got pretty heavy handed in post-production because we, our music had problems. And then Gail really laid into us and said, "Your music sucks and you got to fix it right now." So, but that's what she should do. That's what an executive producer does. Their name is on it because, you know, they're lending their stamp of approval and their expertise. And she was right. Our music didn't work. It was an absolutely delightful experience from top to bottom, from the crew to the cast to the thrill of doing it and being out there every day and the absolutely crazy conditions from snow to 110 degree heat to dust storms to it was wacky.
Well, it's a delight to watch.
It is.
Yes, it is. I agree with you. I never get tired of it.
Okay. Are you ready for the longstanding debate that we've had on this show?
Yes.
All right, Steve. Here we go. I'm going to try and explain it. So I know I kind of told you about it in an email, but I want to make sure any listener that has not heard this, I want to make sure that they understand. And you wrote the movie, so we're not going to argue with you. Well, Justin's going to try not to argue with you. So whatever your answer is, you know, you wrote it. So there it is. Justin feels that Tremors is not science fiction because he does not feel that there's any actual science in it. I feel that it's science fiction due to the graboids being set loose during vibrations caused the Earth to shift, as well as not being worms exactly, but based seemingly on worm features, among other reasons. So what do you, as a writer of the film, say? Is your film Tremors science fiction or not?
Well, I, as a confirmed fan of science fiction, and as one of the opinion that science fiction should take off from a scientific principle and build on it or expand on it or say, what if this physical principle or scientific principle were true, what would happen? I have to say that I think that Tremors is at best science fantasy, if there is that category. I don't think it's true science fiction because you have to look at Tremors 2. The only attempt to explain anything about the graboids takes place in Tremors 2. And in Tremors 1, we very deliberately did not explain where they were from because there's only four possibilities. So we thought it would be funny to simply list the four possibilities and not say what we think it is. Especially because of that, the world is a world in which these giant things exist, and we tried to be true to the physical realities of that. We tried to be true to, well, if there was a 30-foot long thing, how would it move through the earth? And yes, it couldn't go through rock. Even there, you're bending the rules because really, the 30-foot thing, no matter how powerful it was, couldn't go through the dirt. So I have to come down on the side of science fantasy because I don't think there's enough science in, especially in Tremors 1, to defend it as science fiction.
I think that's a happy medium.
Yeah, there you go.
I think it feels like science fiction. I'll go one step further. It feels a little bit like science fiction because it tries to be true to... Once it sets up its fantastical premise, it tries to be true to that premise and not break any of the rules about how the creatures move and how they hear and all of that. So it's true to science physics.
There you go.
As opposed to science fiction.
Hey, I like that answer. It makes us both not lose too much face. Like
I don't want to end your friendship. Yeah.
No, that's going to happen.
Oh, no, he'll find another way to do that. I'm glad that, you know, you were able to come on and really give a thoughtful response to that. I don't remember when this whole thing first started.
Oh, it's been a year at least.
Is it still on, by the way? I tried to find it. Is the argument on where I can see it someplace or not?
I will try to hunt down which, because there's so many episodes. I will try to hunt down which episode it was. I'm pretty sure I can find it.
Well, in our Facebook group that we have, this came up it might have been on my timeline. It was on my timeline because I put up a post saying that some people consider Tremors science fiction. I don't. Here's why. And then from that sprang about 250 replies.
Oh, no, originally started on the show.
It started on the show, but the biggest actual debating of it, I think, came up through that post. And it really went back and forth, you and me, and then me and some others, because, you know, I am very opinionated and I'm very argumentative, especially if I feel like people aren't
agreeing
bending to my will.
Yeah.
So, so it was a long conversation, but one of the posts that really resonated with me and it made me back up a little bit was someone had mentioned that, you know, in the golden era of filmdom, when you had films like the giant ant movie, or King Kong, basically any movie that had a larger than life monster in it was considered science fiction. And because of that, it's now kind of a tradition for these big monster movies to be put in the sci-fi category, even if they're really not. That's just where people are most comfortable putting it. And because of that aspect of nostalgia and tradition, I was willing to back up and say, okay, I can understand why you would consider it science fiction. I don't agree, but I agree that you do see it that way. And we kind of reached a ending of the debate there, but having you come on and give your opinion as well is really nice to have. And I can't thank you enough for not just making the film, but making it so that those of us who are out here, what is it, 20 years later, are still debating it, still talking about it.
I'm glad. No, and I'm glad to do it. I thank you for contacting me. First of all, your questions are well thought of, and I never mind actually talking about this stuff. And it's delightful to me that the debate is going on. I wish I got 200 responses to anything on Facebook. That's great.
Well, you might not feel that way if you actually read them, because
there were a lot of them. I was so close to deleting, but I'm like, no.
Oh,
got to so keep a funny. True accounting, but I will find that post in particular and send you the link to it.
I'll find you the episode.
So if you're bored one afternoon.
Because we had an episode and it got
very
heated.
We did have an episode where
it's great.
I think we got to almost yelling at each other.
Thanks a lot. I realize you got to get going, Steve.
Oddly enough, just at this moment, something came up. But I'm good and happy to do it. And good luck, guys. And by the way, you know, in terms of your own personal desires, the podcast show is a good idea.
Thank you.
To the extent that your numbers are something you can point to, hey, we've got this many listeners, you know, that will help you too.
Absolutely.
So good luck with all of your own efforts. Good luck with the books, Mr. McComber.
Thank you so much. Good luck to you as well with your books.
And you're going to be at Comic-Con, correct?
I am, yes. I'm going to be there with my first ancient book, Puppets and People. I found a few copies of that to sell, and then that's a book on animation.
Okay.
And then with a terrible title that my publisher made me take. And
I like it.
And then the new book, Fraidy Cats. And I'm getting toward the end of the second Fraidy Cats now.
And where are you going to be at? I'm actually going to be there, and I know some of our listeners are going to be there.
Oh, you are? Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. I'm going to be only there Thursday and Friday, and I... And somewhere we'll know what table I'm going to be at. I'm going to be signing at a table,
okay,
in the early afternoon, I think, or 10 to 2 or something. I'm sorry, I don't have it all in front of me.
I will find you. I will come by and say hi.
I will be findable. Thank you.
All right. And our listeners, if you're listening, Steve will be at Comic-Con. If you happen to be there, then be sure to check him out.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Steven.
Thanks a lot for coming.
Bye-bye, guys.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, Justin, what'd you think?
I liked it. You know, I like that he, you know, was able to give a really cogent response to the science fiction question. Is it sci-fi? Is it not? And I felt like, you know, as I mentioned during the recording, that it was a good happy medium. I mean, just to a lot of people, it is science fiction. And I can completely now understand better why people feel that way. And he gave an answer that I feel like kind of satisfies or attempts to satisfy everybody. And it's not, it wasn't some kind of chicken out answer at all. It was true to his opinion. And I think that all of us can now sit back,
just take a breath,
stop debating it. And I felt like we all came to a happy place right in the middle.
You know what I'm going to love is somebody is going to listen to that, to the guy that created it, and they're going to debate his opinion. And I'm just going to be, well, I mean, you could try, but he wrote it. So really whatever he thought is ultimately, it's his creation.
Exactly.
Only he is in his head. What about Kevin Bacon? I mean, did he just forget that his career started with Friday the 13th or what?
Yeah, you know, it's weird that he would... I don't understand... I could understand having that opinion maybe when he was filming the movie. You know, maybe he did feel like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of this desert area with a bunch of rubbery monsters that are, you know, being wiggled at me. This has got to be the complete bottom of my career. But in the years since then, Tremors has really proven to be a cult favorite. People love this movie. I love this movie. You love this movie. Mm-hmm. It has an amazing fan base. And it's not just because of the Graboids. And that seems to be the crux of Kevin Bacon's issue, is that people love the monsters and that's it. I could say for myself, that is not true. I loved Bacon's performance. I thought Fred Ward was so funny. Michael Gross, hysterical. Reba McEntire was, everything was great. So mm-hmm. I really think that he needs to, you know, reevaluate his thoughts on Tremors. Maybe he needs to have some fans send him some emails saying, bro, that was an amazing movie. You need to reevaluate, appreciate or something. I don't know. Maybe we need to get an email writing campaign started.
How would that be? Here's 50,000 emails.
All of them bombarding you, telling you you're wrong about your own opinion.
And he just takes every Tremors poster he can find, burns it.
And that was something that S.S. Wilson mentioned, that he didn't like the poster. I have to say, I love that Tremors poster.
I did like it. I
didn't want to say anything. But yeah, I love that whole Jaws aspect of this thing tunneling up through the ground at our heroes. I think it's a great...
Well, I get probably why he didn't like it. It's just that it's so reminiscent and repetitive of the Jaws poster. I get that. It doesn't separate their film. But it worked for me. I kind of thought it worked for what it was trying to do, which was to emulate those B-movies and take off from other monster movies. So it actually worked for me just fine.
Do you know if they ever came out with Tremors toys?
I'm sure McFarlane Toys has something.
Somebody has to do that, where the little Graboids can, you know, you push them out of the mouth and kind of wiggle them around or something, or drag, you know, the Chang or whatever his name was into the beast itself. Oh, somebody needs to get on making toys for Tremors.
I like that. I like it.
But I love talking with him, and I really appreciate you putting this together, because I never would have thought to do it.
It just struck me, and he was gracious enough to bless us with his time, which was very nice. He didn't have to do it. He's got other stuff going on. So, well, thanks, Justin, for being here. Guys, remember, you can go to iTunes, Stitcher, thehollywoodoutsider.com is the website. Any parting thoughts, Justin?
Thanks to S.S. Wilson for coming on. Thanks to you. Thanks to all of our listeners who have been involved in this debate, discussion, however you want to phrase it. And hopefully this matter is put to rest and we can find something new to argue about.
Sounds good to me.
Sounds good.
Let's pick something else and we'll start a war.
That's right. I'll just make up an opinion. F it.
That sounds about right.
It sounds like what you do all the time. Yeah. Isn't that what you wanted to say?
No, never. Never. Let's debate that. How much does Justin like to debate? Let's debate it.
Too much.
All right, guys. Well, thanks for being here. And as always, remember, the next time you go to a theater, buy popcorn.
We can make it! Stupid son of a bitch. Knocked itself cold. Called my ass. He's dead. Well, he killed him. We killed it. Fuck you!